Hello, everyone. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Paul Taylor, the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. Tonight, we'll be continuing our exploration with the inspirational futurist Barbara Marx Hubbard, who more than any other single person has popularized the idea of conscious evolution. Terry Patton is the visionary behind this groundbreaking series and our host. Terry is a leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality, who supports, challenges, guides, and connects evolutionaries all over the world. He is the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice, and his personal website is integralspiritualpractice.com. Warm welcome, Terry.
Thank you so much, Paul. And hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening. As you probably know, this series is devoted to an exploration of the intersection between that which never changes and that which is absolutely changing faster than it ever. Things are changing faster than ever, and in that sense, they are more the way they've always been than they ever have. We're in a really unique moment of crisis and challenge, but also of exciting advances. And obviously, human beings are being called to rise to a moment of punctuated equilibrium, a jump, an evolutionary transition point. And the spirit, the feeling, the inspiration with which we can do that is clearly something that relates to our spirituality. And yet spirituality has always claimed to be that which roots us to that which transcends all experience, which goes beyond birth and beyond death. So is our spirituality in this moment going to evolve? Is it called upon, and are we called upon to change in some way in our spiritual practice, in our way of relating to one another and to fellow practitioners? So we've had a series of really probing and interesting and enlivening conversations in which we've focused on different aspects of this theme. And tonight, I am just delighted to be joined in conversation by Barbara Marx Hubbard in a dialogue we've decided to title Conscious Evolution, Communing with a Future That Wants to Manifest Through Us. Buckminster Fuller called Barbara the best-informed human now alive regarding futurism. A noted author, futurist, citizen diplomat, and social architect, Barbara is one of the prophetic voices who brought into being the emergent evolutionary worldview. And this idea that she has for years been bringing to people all over the world is truly at the heart of this whole series. Daughter of toy tycoon Lewis Marx, she graduated from Bryn Mawr College and studied at École des Sciences Politiques and the prestigious Sorbonne in Paris. In the 1960s, she published one of the first newsletters on evolutionary transformation. It was called the Center Letter, in collaboration with Abraham Maslow. And during those years, she also worked closely with Jonas Salk. In 1966, she was a founding member of the World Future Society, the leading futurist organization in the world right now, certainly in the United States. And in the 1970s, she organized and co-produced 25 SynCons, Synergistic Conferences, and the Multimedia Theater for the Future. In 1984, she made political history when her name was placed in nomination for the vice presidency of the U.S. at the Democratic Convention. That was the year that another woman, first actual nominee, Geraldine Ferraro, got that nomination. During the 1980s, she developed and co-chaired a number of U.S.-Soviet citizen summits, and in 1992, she co-founded the Foundation for Conscious Evolution. She's created and hosted a number of groundbreaking TV shows and movies, including the television series Potentials and Humanity Ascending, and Visions of a Universal Humanity, both of which you can buy at her website. We'll give you some information about that later. She's the author of many books, including Conscious Evolution, Emergence, and The Evolutionary Journey. Speaking personally, I've really come to love Barbara, and one of the many things I love about her is her passion. truly an awakened evolutionary passion, and the authenticity of the she's a true mystic of evolution. Earlier this year, I gave her a call after she had been sick, and I wanted to see how she was doing. But she really didn't have much interest in talking about her health. She kind of covered it quickly. It was fine, but she'd been up all night the night before, not due to pain. She said she was just so excited that she couldn't sleep. She was thinking about emergence, evolutionary emergence, and evolutionary convergence, two key principles. And she was just contemplating how the new emergence of our time would converge. That's what kept her up all night, not thinking about herself. What a spirit she is, a true joy, and in many ways, I think, a saint of conscious evolution. I'm so happy to have you with us, Barbara, and welcome in every way.
Well, thank you, Terry. You know, it's a joy for me to talk with you, to be with you, to explore this with you, and I'm so grateful for the series you're doing. Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, well, it's my honor. Now, Barbara, you're primarily associated with the idea of evolution, and you're really an evolutionary prophet and mystic, but during the last few weeks, I think we've been focusing a little more on the spiritual side of the, you know, this is obviously a paradox because these things are not separate or separable, but I think the spiritual teachers we've spoken with have been emphasizing the radical matter of surrender, of letting go, of releasing, of just being itself, of love, of the relaxation of effort. You know, as Ram Dass said in the interview I had with him recently, being love now as the bottom line of a true existence. And I know you're familiar with these principles and that they inform your life. How would you encourage us to think about how this matter of radical freedom relates to the urgency of our current moment of crisis and transformation and the call of evolution?
You know, Terry, going from my own experience, the beingness, the ground of being, when I'm able to be in that state, immediately there arises within me from that beingness an impulse of creation, of creativity, of expression. And as I began to study evolution itself, I saw that I was quite literally experiencing the way evolution emerges from no thing at all. And I feel that the evolutionary consciousness that's coming into form is a new synthesis of pure beingness, the ground of being, the source, the field, out of which everything is emerging, everything that has emerged, and everything that is emerging in this instant of time. When I'm, I would say, in my fullest evolutionary consciousness, is both being and doing without that division. It's like an incarnation of the impulse of creation as a co-creator with it. And it feels to me like a sense of an arrow of evolution within me as well. It has direction. And it's more than I just have work to do or a project to do. Is I am the doingness. I'm the being doing. I'm a leaf leafing. And I don't see the distinction when I'm, I would say, in my highest state of being. When I fall out of that being, then I can feel, what shall I do next? Or how can I stop? Or I'm 81 years old. You know, I used to say, don't you think I could stop now? I would say to this impulse of creation, why are you waking me up in the morning with this passion to create? And I realized that's because I am evolution. We are an expression of evolution. That's who we are.
Yes. Well, you know, this in the introduction to this series, Barbara, I talked a little bit about how, in a very real sense, as this series of tremendous insights has arisen into cosmic evolution, the images and discoveries from the Hubble telescope, the interlinking thematics that connect cosmic evolution with biological evolution and even cultural evolution and the evolution of consciousness, that we really are the eyes of evolution opening to ourself, that we are evolution seeing ourself for the first time in really pretty much in certainly in your lifetime, and I think, you know, most of it really, you know, in mine, and really more and more every decade, you know, so dramatically. And I find it unutterably beautiful that should be happening right as we have access to all the spiritual traditions of mankind, and right as we have to begin to cooperate and make choices that have evolutionary effect at a level that we've never cooperated before. Just the convergence of these things is a breathtaking synergy.
Yes, you know, if you look at the cosmogenesis story and you see, you know, from energy to matter to life to animal life to human life, and then to the higher forms of human life in the great spiritual adepts and those who have had this, I would say, experience of oneness source being, it seems to me that we are living through another turn on the spiral, and that I call it conscious evolution. That through the discovery of cosmogenesis and through the realization that we have certain crises that we are creating that could destroy our biosphere, as well as new capacities that make it possible for us to literally co-evolve with nature and beyond, that we are privileged to live at the time of the evolution of evolution, from a more unconscious process to a more conscious, choiceful process. And that shift is being caused by the entire state of reality that we're facing. I mean, for me, it started with the U.S. dropping the atomic bombs on Japan, and I was 15 years old. And as I've mentioned to you before, Terry, I literally had a shock realizing that self-consciousness with this degree of power would not long prevail.
Mm.
I could see it. And if you think from 1945 to 2010, the escalation of power that is really at the source of certainly the environmental crisis and other aspects of our crisis. So I saw the crises themselves were evolutionary drivers, that when we respond to them and ask what is emergent out of this, what's emergent out is you and me on this phone in the noosphere, capable of even conceiving of co-evolving, co-creating, both in terms of response to the crisis, but even deeper than that is response to the potential of a conscious evolutionary epoch, when you would combine spiritual, social, and scientific capabilities, you begin to see the evolution of a universal species. Mm-hmm. And this may be the deepest way of saying it, is that it's a species-wide transformation occurring, that when you have this title, The Future Calling Us, one of the things that I learned in the futurist movement is that we need images of the future equal to our potential, or we have a hard time moving toward it. So I began to ask, what would it be like if everything worked? And that's how I became a futurist.
Well, you've always been someone who stood in, it seems to me, a profoundly spiritual relationship to the whole matter. One aspect of it is that you have always stood in the gap, in the question, with a great sense of possibility. And then the other thing is that you stand with a sense of a kind of faith, a kind of fundamentally the goodness of existence is obvious to your heart, it seems like, and that's certainly what you radiate. And so there's a kind of a sense of wonder and a sense of possibility, even though you face, you know, the truly, you know, daunting and sobering and frightening, you know, realities of various crises. You do it in a way that stands in a sort of faith relationship to the larger evolutionary process and a deep sense of wonder. And I think that there's a way that, you know, you've described a little bit to me about your own process. I hope maybe you'll describe a little bit of it to others, that there's a kind of communing with that future, that those images, as you say, that can call us forward, that you open yourself up to be given an intuitive sense of possibility so that it can find its way into this world through you. And in many ways, you've been a vehicle through which a vision of a positive future and a conscious future and a phase change into a new era, you know, have been able to find articulation and kind of an inspiring presencing.
Well, you know, when I began to learn and understand, and you might say almost experience, the miracle of the 13.7 billion years from nothing at all, that the universe mysteriously, mystically, beyond any scientific or purely spiritual understanding, was able to create a universe. And that in this universe, not only the billions of galaxies and trillions of planets, but our own Earth and Earth life and human life becoming conscious of this. So I became a futurist from looking at that past. And it doesn't take a lot of faith to be awed by the emergence of this entire universe and us within it from nothing at all, from source, from spirit. So my faith actually came from the experience of the revelation, you might say, of cosmogenesis. And then I began to see, when I placed ourselves in that process, I could see that our current crises was not something that had never happened before, that it was like a fractal of crisis precedes transformation, problems or evolutionary drivers. So I placed myself in the 13.7 billion years, and it didn't take faith for me to have a sense of expectation of what's emergent. There's a nice phrase I read somewhere, I don't remember exactly where, but the phrase was, evolution optimizes. See, sometimes people say, Barbara, aren't you optimistic? I'll say, well, I'm an evolutionary in the sense that evolution optimizes. From nothing at all, it optimizes the whole universe. So when I put ourselves in this precise moment and realize the tendency in evolution to optimize out of crises, then what happens as an evolutionary is you begin to seek what is emergent. Now, this doesn't mean you're Pollyanna or that you inevitably feel that this is going to work even. You just know that the tendency in evolution, and I got this from Teilhard de Chardin and Ken Wilber and many others, Sri Aurobindo, the tendency in evolution is towards greater complexity, greater consciousness, greater freedom of choice, all up the entire evolutionary chain of being. And so there's no reason, I don't even have to have faith to have noticed that. I think I'd have to be blind to not have noticed, once I learned that we're evolving. Now, where my faith started to come in was the attraction for what's emergent, because it has not happened yet. And I got this impulse by being very frustrated in my own life when I was a wife and mother of five children and had this deep sense of something more. Something wanted to be expressed through me, and that was the end of the 1950s. I'm that generation of women before we heard anything about this. and Betty Friedan wrote about us in The Feminine Mystique. Well, I felt I must be sick. I had five children, and this impulse for something more. Went to the local psychiatrist. He, you know, gave a Freudian analysis of this impulse. And it wasn't until I read Maslow that I understood what was within me was the yearning for vocation, for life purpose, for expression. And then when I read Teilhard de Chardin, and he started to see God in evolution, he saw matter as an expression of divine essence all the way on up, and he put forward a vision of the future. And I believe that vision that attracted me originally to becoming a futurist with all of this was the vision of the noosphere, the thinking layer of Earth. We're talking through the noosphere right now. The noosphere came with language, culture, all the art forms, all the systems, and now, of course, science, technology, communications. We're in a living organism of vast intelligence, global mind, intelligence, heart, that has been created through human endeavor. And he saw that thinking layer of Earth beginning to connect heart with heart and center with center. There was an interiorization within the thinking layer of Earth, as there is in the formation of any whole system. And that interiorization he called the Christification of the Earth. He was a Catholic Jesuit paleontologist. Now, you don't have to use Christian language for it. I began to see it as the attractor was the connection of the interior heart, love, yearning for oneness and wholeness combined with the intelligence of a global universal species getting its collective eyes. And I would say, Terry, I had a conversion experience at the thought of the noosphere getting its collective eyes. And I realized as a woman, I was about in my early 30s by then, in the early 60s, I realized that the force inside me that was considered neurotic in that interpretation of the Freudian analyst was actually the universe within me evolving. And I became, I had a new identity, which I see for everyone, is that we are the universe in person. And the universe is always emergent toward more. So particularly as a woman, and this may be related to the feminine impulse, is that when the woman falls in love with that emergent potential within herself, and she's not going to be reproducing the species anymore, what is she doing? She's giving birth to that authentic feminine self. She's giving birth to the co-creator within her as a feminine expression of divine intent. And that is as powerful in the next phase of life as being pregnant, giving birth, and feeling the unconditional love of the newborn child. The woman, as myself and many, many others, feel this unconditional, passionate love of what we're giving birth to. And it's unknown. We don't have to know what the future is going to be. But in pregnancy, you expect the baby is important no matter what it looks like. You love it. So the attraction for me of the noosphere gaining its collective eyes resonated with a deep intuitive knowing that the potential of evolution would not stop here with us and with the misuse of our power and with just simply going within to oneness and dissolution of individual self. I knew that we were becoming a universal human and a universal humanity, and that my impulse is an expression of that, and it comes out both by inner getting in touch with the essence of being, but also with the impulse of creation localized as a personal expression.
So the this falling in love with the emergent and feeling a mother's love, but you might say a co-creative feminine love, you found yourself feeling that you could somehow be of service. You really did begin to articulate a lot of critical new ideas at a time when they were not very widely held, and in a way advanced certainly the vision that Teilhard de Chardin, expressed, which is so inspiring to everyone. But you really took it several steps further, I'm curious. Do you feel that you have a unique role as a woman? Is it different than from men who are passionate evolutionaries like myself or many of your other colleagues? How does that elaborate, and how does that relate to this the sense of just being in love? The kind of peaceful spiritual foundation that this all arose from.
Well, I really believe that an evolutionary woman or an evolutionary man shares a great deal in common with this impulse. We coined this phrase, Terry. We used it when we were speaking before the Integral Theory Group. The word is telerotic, telos, and eros. And it's an erotic, juicy love for what's emergent and the higher purpose within you. I know that men and women have that almost identically. However, there is a difference in the woman's physio-psycho reality. And what I've noticed in myself, because the woman's body is different, she can get pregnant and give birth and create another being. Now, that is a total miracle. And I've had 5 children, so it's very deep in my psyche. And the reason I think there's a feminine uniqueness in this is that when I fell in love with an expression of my own higher purpose toward giving it into the world, it really transcends the word service. It's like you don't feel service when you're having a baby. Well, I'm going to serve the world by taking care of the baby. It's much deeper than that. It's, and I think Maslow understood it when he said, self-actualization is neither selfless nor selfish. It's self-actualizing and indeed self-transcending. Now, when the woman falls in love with an expression of life purpose, it activates some of the same physiological feelings in her. She gets more energy. She gets excited. She I've coined a word, regenopause. It feels like postmenopausal women who fall in love with life purpose are gaining an energy that has a unique passion to it that perhaps is different than a man who feels a very similar energy might be feeling. But ultimately, the important thing is that we're both feeling this, and that when you feel it, it transcends the idea, I have to do this for service. It is the expression of life purpose being the life pulse within you. And I was trying to describe to you that I don't feel a distinction between doing and being when I'm expressing that which is emerging within me. And it doesn't even feel like it's happening only in response to crisis or problems or even projects, although it does take on those characteristics. It's more like the way in which your whole being is expressing itself. And I feel the impulse of evolution localizes in each of us personally when we're responsive to it as our own unique expression. And we get attracted to giving that expression. When you're giving that which is your life purpose, you have a almost an immediate response of joy. Giving one's life purpose, particularly if you're in resonance with 2 or more that seem to be able to receive it, you start to experience social synergy. like when you and I work together, Terry, I have a yearning to express. You have a certain desire to express, and we interacted in such a way that we were more than the sum of our parts. So at this level, the expression becomes co-creation, and we're shifting from procreation, reproducing ourselves through sexual interaction, to evolving ourselves through suprasexual or co-creative interaction. And nature has put joy into that. Mm-hmm. Nature has put love into that. It's juicy.
Yes.
It's juicy, and there's an incentive to do more of it because it feels so good. And hopefully it's useful.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting, you know, there's a certain satisfaction that comes from any creative act, but when there's this sense of being connected to something much larger, and that's why the word communing was meaningful to me. I know that in my journey into this sense of spiritual, evolutionary, there's an awakening, a telluric awakening in my heart and being that the sense of merely doing a creative project and doing it satisfactorily, which is certainly something I've done in many ways across my lifetime, it wasn't only that. It was really about being a vehicle through which something much larger than myself could do its creative work, and that was even more satisfying. And in that way, I think even though I'm, you know, perfectly masculine, you know, character and heterosexual and all that, there's a kind of yielding to that larger force that's a kind of receptivity and a kind of ecstatic surrender that does have almost a feminine side to it. I think then that in our work, our collaborative work for, you know, specifically, and I think this probably generalizes, you know, for others, there's a sense you're surrendering to something larger, I'm surrendering to something larger, and then somehow that future that is wanting to make its way into form is finding its way more fully through the us than it could have through me or you, and the biggerness of that usness joins us in a kind of ecstatic, like, oh, thank you, good, we have a vehicle for more to come through. Is that how you feel it?
Yes, that's very well put. The joining of the two or more in creative expression, it feels like the strange attractor is that which hasn't yet fully been born out of that interaction. But you can feel it, and that's on a personal level, that the attractor is something that calls you to express more of your love, more of your creativity, more of your sense of potentiality. And there is no doubt that by joining with two or more in that kind of creativity, that you are expressing more of your own essence, and you're being attracted by the future to it pulling you forward, because you can see that what you're expressing is creating something that is very attractive. And just on that score, I wrote a foreword to Irvin Laszlo's book, Chaos Point 2012, in which he very clearly describes in chaos theory what a chaos window and chaos point is like, when the system is breaking down, when the system is out of equilibrium. It tries to go back to find a structure that it can balance it. If it can't, like in our society, we can't just grow more, have more military, have more prisons. It's not working. But so when you find that, a chaotic system seeks a higher order. And if there is a benign higher order that attracts it, it can jump. But if there is not, it can go into lower orders like a mafia or a Nazi. It can go into very diabolical forms of order, but it will seek higher structure. So I sense when we're working, like with this whole series that you're doing, if I put it into that context, it's creating a strange attractor with all these different spiritual experiences that would give anyone the sense of that toward which we are moving. And that starts to have a much greater effect on a system out of equilibrium than it would at a time when the system is relatively static. So just going back to the point of joining together to create and being attracted, this is exactly what evolution is doing. Right now, for us to create that which attracts us, and they also call it a chaotic attractor, that attracts the chaos to a higher order. And it doesn't have to be everybody getting something. It has to be enough that somehow tips a small fluctuation in a sea of social chaos. So I think these teleseminars, as an example, are extremely important because they are formulating it, with many voices, a strange attractor for human spirituality and creativity, and it could make the difference.
You know, that bringing up of the strange attractor is, I just love that analogy, and it's meaningful to me that the physicist who did the original work on dissipative systems, Ilya Prigogine, began towards the end of his life, he began to believe that this was a principle that worked in chaotic human social and cultural systems, not just in vats of chemicals and in physics, that the increasing chaos in a certain moment could lead to a leap to a higher order, and this principle of the strange attractor, the only way that you can do the math of how that chaotic system arises to a higher order is to go forward in time and see the new order that emerges and insert that as a mathematical function in the old chaotic system and do the math from there. It's as if something from the future manifests in the midst of the chaos, and this sense of opening to the future that wants to manifest through us and being really, for me, it is a real practice, because just like in many practices, you know, we as egos can get in the way so easily, and my agendas and my desire to be meaningful or important and my ambitions and, you know, all the rest of it are not what this is all about. That there really is a very profound kind of openness and stillness, a kind of just being love in some of the ways that I was referring to, you know, that Ram Dass talked about, just really
yes.
being open and deeply attuned so that what is really true, not my agendas, but something greater, can I be a nerve ending in the, you know, the brain of the globe, you know, the global brain of humanity that can intuit that future that's wanting to find its way into form, a kind of huge because, you know, it's so much of what is creating our crisis right now has to do with our habits and our patterns. You know, it isn't so much an exterior problem of engineering or environment and ecology. If we behaved as wisely as we could, if we were able to open to a much larger simplicity and let that simplicity find its way into form through us, if we were truly transcending the old patterns, tremendous new things would be possible. And that, you know, can we be at the part of be playing a part in a cultural transition that opens it? I sense that we can, and I'm dedicating myself to trying to bring that about, but there are many pieces of what needs to come into being that haven't manifested yet, so I still stand here listening, you know, for that strange attractor.
Well, you know, Terry, Fortunately, we're not in charge of the whole universe. Somebody, you know, I was always saying we have to find out what works, and somebody said to me, Barbara, you know what works? The universe works. The sun seems to be there every day. The whole incredible sense of order, coordination at a universal scale. And this is part of my evolutionary faith, that somehow there has been a process, and I think Prigogine helped us see it. Let me just mention my understanding of that. One of the things I understood from this dissipative structure is that when a system becomes more and more dysfunctional, it uses more of its energy in handling its own dysfunctionalities. And during that time, there are many novel mutations, if it's at the biological level, and we could call it social innovations and cultural innovations at the social, at the human level, and the novel interactions of that which is emergent, just like this whole series you're doing, and you and me on the phone right this moment, those novel interactions, there's a tendency in nature itself for there to be a non-linear exponential interaction of what's emergent, and the system jumps. So there's a tendency. This is not a neutral universe, according to this view, and we wouldn't be here if it were just an accidental universe, in my opinion. So the novel interactions of those of us who are at an emerging edge of creativity in every field, health, education, economics, spirituality, energy, and so on, that the tendency in nature to connect that which is emergent, to that which is, let's say, working toward a higher pattern, that there is a sense of imminence for me as the connectivity, and largely through internet now, is getting more and more connected, for better or for worse. Not only are those things that are dyssynergistic connecting towards possible breakdown, but those things that are synergistic are connecting, those things that are novel are connecting. And so this is an evolutionary faith, that because the time frame is so short in the breakdown that we're facing, as we've been told, that the environment particularly could become completely dyssynergistic within our lifetime, it seems to me it also could jump to a higher order of synergy in our lifetime. That would be greater connectivity, novel interactions, so that there would be a sense of the system itself jumping to a higher order. Now, I think that does take a certain degree of faith. And I thought, Terry, I'd like to just mention what I've learned about how to help that happen. Mm. I call it the four S's. This is on social behavior. The first S is called syntony. And I learned this word from Eric Jantz in a book, Design for Evolution. And he felt that as a DNA is a information system that affects the RNA and builds a cell, which builds a body, that we each have within us a syntony or a harmonic of that impulse that is unique to each of us, that's a part of the design of creation that we are coded with. And when we pick up to that pattern, that there's a harmony where we feel we know which way to move, which way to build, which way to go, and that intuition of life expression he called syntony, and you can feel it when you're on it. It's a harmonic, it's joyful, it has an ease and a flow to it. The second S is synergy, that when you get to be part of a group where what you're giving actually increases what somebody else can give, and where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, we know nature forms ever more complex holons. So when you're following a syntony inside yourself and you're part of a larger whole and the whole is greater than the sum of your parts, you become more, and the whole system becomes more. And then a third one, S, is synchronicities. Carl Jung was very interested in synchronicities, and I have thought that it might be an early understanding of the fact that the system itself has design. I don't mean that it's totally predetermined, but it's prepotential. So as you get to be more tuned into that which is your impulse, that you're picking up almost by a frequency, and you're part of a whole system greater than the sum of your parts, design seems to show up. So you get the right phone call, the right book, but even more than that, things start to seem to work. What you need in order to create shows up, whereas before you were having this experience, it looked like you were plodding the whole way through. And the fourth S is suprasex, which is the same drive of sexuality that gets you to join your genes to create babies, gets you to join your genius. Like you and I right now on this phone, there's a desire from my unique creativity to join with yours to find out more than we could otherwise. So the four S's support the prigogine idea of the, when you have all these novel interactions, what do you do? Well, as a conscious evolutionary, I attempt to practice those S's. Are you there? Whoops.
Hello, Barbara. Hello. Hello, Barbara. Hello, Barbara.
Terry? Hello? Hello? Hello?
Hello, I'm back. Barbara,
hello.
Are you? Hello, I'm back.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, are you back?
I am.
Oh, dear, I don't know what happened. It just stopped.
We had a very synchronistic power failure here in Fairfax, California.
It's raining here, too. I hope it didn't do it. But anyway, I wonder how many of the four S's you got. I was giving my big aria on the four S's, and maybe you didn't get any of them.
No, I got most of them. We were beyond synchronicity, I think, as I disappeared into the power void. I was thinking how synchronistically odd it was. I hope this isn't too confusing for others.
You missed Super Sex then.
I missed Super Sex, darn.
Well, that's the one you already know a lot. So anyway, well, that's good. I'm glad to hear your voice, Terry.
Yeah, well, I was calling back in the first time I called in. For some reason, it didn't connect, so it took me a little
longer. Okay.
So coming back to this whole conversation, this reflects just the power interruption. Isn't it interesting? I feel my smallness in a way. Here I am, completely dependent on an electrical grid that can be interrupted easily enough in this little wooded hamlet where I sit. And I'm imagining, great things, 13.7 billion year trajectories. I'm alive to these very, and I think this is one of the criticisms that we hear from some people. They kind of say, well, you guys are just, on a pipe dream. This is so grandiose and so big, and so you ground yourself in your ordinary human lives, and how can you there is that kind of skepticism that we sometimes hear voiced, and I suppose this is an occasion to dance with that, because the power failure is almost a presencing of it.
Terry, I don't feel that way about it. You see, if I think about my ordinary, anybody's ordinariness, I am 50 trillion cells organized without any consciousness on my part, creating a being capable of conscious thing. And I remember once somebody said to Buckminster Fuller, Dr. Fuller, I don't like technology. And he put his hand forward and wiggled his thumb, and he said, do you like your thumb? And, the idea was you had a thought, and that thumb moved. Now, there's nothing, I'm in awe that happens, much less that we're on a planet that itself is giving birth to all these forms of life in a universe of untold dimensions. So the person who says, well, let's have your ordinary daily life and don't be so grandiose, that means you don't even notice how grandiose everything else already is. You see what I mean? And so that doesn't mean necessarily that all our technologies will work, but it means that nature has a tendency of enormous intelligence of creating these complex systems. So there's no reason to assume that we humans could not also move in that direction. It's not grandiose. It's natural.
And I think that for myself, I find myself grounding myself in the concrete goodness I can do in tangible ways that affect real people, so that this inspiration and vision is it's a vision that's shared in a field of love and self-criticism and the kind of, we stay humbly related to the fact that every great possibility is still manifested through it can only be manifested through real people, in some sense, humbly putting their shoulder to the wheel of actual doings, and I keep trying to do that, and in a sense submitting myself to a transformational process that in which I'm in service with others of something greater than myself, and continually grounding in that way. That is, and yet anything less
than a deep time perspective. Anything less than an evolutionary perspective, anything less than an appreciation that evolution has speeded up in our lifetimes so fast that what we do does affect the future of cultural evolution, which will dictate the future of our whole planet and biosphere. And that therefore a kind of responsibility, a co-creative responsibility, that I am only one, 6.8 billionths of but I can stand in as noble a way as I can as a part of the way that a healthy evolutionary future can manifest itself, and that doing that isn't grandiose, it's actually humble. And even though many times things will demonstrate to me my smallness, like this little power failure, I am I'm sort of ennobled by my willingness to be humbled.
You're proud of your humility.
There you go. I don't know if that's going to pass muster with the true states. Does this resonate for you? How do you work with that aspect of things?
Well, I certainly agree with you that being in service, in love, in care of others, in the humbleness of what any one of us could possibly do is absolutely right. I just want to say that I have a sense of awe of the so-called ordinary. See, there's nothing ordinary to me about the miracle of there being a planet with life on it, with human life becoming conscious of evolution, consciously affecting it. So no matter how... or having a baby, going to a garden, planting vegetables and seeing them grow, I have a sense of awe and wonder at everything. And then what I should do within that is humble, for sure, because no one of us can do anything more than whatever our best is in love and service. However, because I always feel the impulse of evolution moving through every organ and as a fiber of my being, there's nothing ordinary about it. And I wanted to say, since we talked about spiritual practices, one that I really like, I call the evolutionary chakra meditation. And if you can visualize the evolutionary spiral of the universe, Earth, life, so on, I see a core of the spiral, which could be symbolizing universal intelligence, could be symbolizing the process of creation, the divine spirit in action. And so I first of all take it from the mind of God, from the mind of the infinite, all the way up through the formation until I get to Earth and life and myself. And then I take that core and bring it through every chakra, to the Muladhara, to ground my security in that 13.7 billion years of experience. And then I take it up to the generative organs, and I realize that I'm moving from reproduction to co-creation, to self-evolution. So the generative organs are being evolved, and it goes up into the power center, the emotions, and then in the heart, it's the unconditional love for the process of creation. It's all some love that out of the tremendous effort of evolution has come this life form that we know. And then I love to take that spiral up to vocation, to the upper heart in my experience, where this purpose, like your purpose, my purpose, everyone's expression, is an aspect of the impulse of evolution. As you, as me. And I take it up into the throat chakra so that the voice and your expression is not just my purpose is, but this impulse within me is expressing through me as. And then you feel like, you're with a process so much greater than you that humility is hardly even a word for it, because it's really a sense of the expression of the divine through each of us. And to the degree that you can be in alignment of it, you can't do it if you're egoically separated from it. You can't really experience it as a compulsive, separated, egoic person. So the release of ego into essence has been for me a practice. And then I get up into vocation and expression and all the way up into the third eye and beyond. I bring the core of the spiral up through as an evolving energy, up to the highest frequencies I'm capable of experiencing, way beyond my own essential self, and then bringing it down through the top of the head, all the way down and up and down, until I am, you might say, experiencing the frequency of the universal process of creation as within me. And that's within everybody. It's just noticing it. In a way, conscious evolution is noticing that evolution is occurring through us, and if we consciously align with its tendency to bring out of crisis innovation, creativity, emergence, you start looking for it and you start bringing it into form by your attention and your attraction. So I don't think there's anything Pollyanna about this. I don't think there's anything about not being humble. It's being in awe, actually, and being grateful at every moment that you're able to be alive and conscious, particularly at a time when evolution is becoming conscious through us.
Yeah, beautiful.
You know, it's a big, deep breath here. And even in speaking with you, what I've noticed in expressing this is my sense, I think gratitude is too narrow a word. It's almost overwhelming grace to be in existence and have even an opportunity to touch upon one's own potential within this crisis of emergence. It's the way people, I think, mystics have felt about God. I feel about the impulse of evolution.
Well, which is, I mean,
is
are,
the
they,
form
are they
of
separable?
The Godhead. It's the Godhead. You know, it's
yeah.
The, I like Aurobindo. You know, he says there's the eternal, and then there's basically the evolving Godhead. So I am imbued with the awesome, I would say, gratitude, love, joy of the evolving Godhead within each one of us and within the whole.
So beautiful. And in a way that brings so many of these themes full circle. Well, Barbara, I want to keep going with you. I'd like, you know, as you know, and as we have, we can go for hours. We are at that time when I should be inviting some others into the conversation. So if you're listening by the web, please go ahead and type out a concise question in the instant teleseminar window starting now. And if you've called in by phone, if you press *2 just once, that will raise your hand, and I'll know that you want to ask a question. But before we go to answer any questions, I have a couple of announcements. A number of you have asked us about the hold music that we play before the call begins, and that's a piece entitled Only an Enjoyment from the album by Ray Lynch entitled Nothing Above My Shoulders But the Evening Sky. His album Deep Breakfast went platinum without him performing or touring, just based on the depth and beauty of the timeless sounds. And you can purchase them at raylynch.com or via iTunes. That's raylynch.com. Also, to find out more about Barbara Marks Hubbard's work, I encourage you to go to barbaramarkshubbard.com, or even better, go to evolvingnow.com. That's evolvingnow.com, and you can directly subscribe to her free newsletter. Also, stay tuned, and at the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about my upcoming interviews this week. I'll be speaking with the remarkable contemporary American spiritual teacher Adya Shanti about the inner revolution of spiritual awakening on Thursday in just 4 days. And next Sunday at this same time, I'll be speaking with Dr. Mark Gaffney. Okay, let's take a look. Do we have some questions? Yes. Quite a few, some interesting. Well, here's one from a mutual friend of ours. Daryl Lahem asks,
oh,
is there a male version of regenopause? He says hi to us both, and he asks that question.
I know there is, Daryl, from knowing you.
Oh, he's too young.
It can happen at any age. You know, I think that there is, and it's a very, very wonderful question. Women's bodies, of course, go through menopause, and there's a major reality of not having no more eggs. And the thing I've noticed about the male is that while the woman has no more eggs, the man does not stop at all having sperm. And I did come up with a theory called the plight of the lonely sperm, because I'm wondering what all that sperm is for when women either have no more eggs or contraception. So for regenopause of the male, and the male, see, I think the woman's sexuality in regenopause continues upward into creativity. I haven't noticed that the male sexuality diminishes as they get older. So I would have to ask the men, this is a very good question, and we could have a wonderful dialogue on that, Terry and Daryl.
I'd like to know
what other people think. Yes.
So what you're kind of saying is that a certain aspect of your biological potentiation sublimes itself in service of something bigger than what you can bodily bring into being. You bring it, kind of, it shifts from the biological to the noosphere.
I think so. I think, you know,
uh-huh.
Because it's such an amazing miracle that our bodies produce eggs, and if one gets fertilized, our body starts to create a new being. That is, talk about ordinary miracles. So if our body can do that, and we are living 50, 60, 70, 80, and onwards, I have coined the phrase, now we're the egg. Because, you see, I don't think we've yet seen the full, authentic, feminine, co-creative self on this planet within a maturing noosphere. I think it's almost an emerging aspect of our species. And the men, because the patriarchy is coming to, its conclusion of, it's not operative, it will destroy us. The best men that I know are coming up out of the patriarchy towards the whole man, the evolutionary man. And I have always felt it's harder for the men now than the women. Because they're coming up out of a much stronger structure of the patriarchy, and there's not yet a new social structure, a social synergy. The women, because we didn't partake of the patriarchy, are actually more free to create new structures, and we don't have as much social pressure on us. Like, there's absolutely no social pressure for women 60, 70, 80 is what they're supposed to be doing. Mainly would have been dead, or we would have had huge numbers of grandchildren. So we are actually cultural evolvers. And the men are struggling to move beyond the patriarchy, and I think it's harder for them.
That's something Jean Houston was saying, is that there is a kind of special leadership that women are asserting, and there are some men who are co-creating with them, but that many strong men who would otherwise be leaders are still kind of trying to work the old paradigm.
I think, and if they get out of the old paradigm and try to be in the new, I have noticed it's harder for a man to do that because he's leaving a structure that had prestige and power and he was trained for, particularly the older generation. I think the younger men have a much easier time. And I think that every evolutionary woman I know also yearns for male partnership with evolutionary men that love to be with them, co-create with them, whether or not it's a romantic relationship. In my case, I have really love men. And I've been inspired by the male genius. Every single great inspiration I have had, whether it be in the ancient times, you know, Jesus is one of my great, you know, sources of inspiration. But then Aurobindo, Teilhard de Chardin, Buckminster Fuller, Abraham Maslow, there have not been women of that stature that particularly inspired me. So as I become a co-creative woman, I find the male genius to be extremely exciting, and I really have felt that I've incarnated male genius to give birth to it through a feminine expression of it.
Yeah, I can relate, because there's a way in which you're very feminine being on all kinds of different levels, but you're also very intelligent. So there's a kind of engagement that I at the level of my own so-called masculine qualities of discrimination and analysis and all the rest, I feel like you show up. So there is a kind of, there is a dimension to our synergy that is a play within a kind of clarity and comprehension that's kind of a masculine mode that's still with the energies of our embodied qualities, which
it's
are
the logos.
Yeah.
You know, loving the logos.
Yes, that's
the,
it.
The intelligent, the word. And I think that the whole woman and whole man is something that is an emergent part of our species. And I'm just making the point, I believe it's easier for the woman right now to become a co-creator than for a man to leave the old structure and be free as a woman is to be able to express that unique essence in the world. And I have a lot of empathy for the men who are moving in that direction, because we yearn for them. We need them. We can't do this. So this is not about women doing this alone. It's co-creative partnerships all the way through.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much. Well, I want to get to some more questions. We have one from Glasgow, from Scotland, from Kay Dorr, who says, "Namaste." That's nice. See that we're very much a global culture. Scotland begin with a Sanskrit greeting. Would you be willing to share with us your personal spiritual practice, which allows opening to the higher state?
Well, yes. One of them is that evolutionary chakra meditation,
which you just shared. Yes.
You know, where you bring the core of the spiral up through every chakra and down, and until you feel that you are self-evolving by incarnating the actual impulse of evolution. And just on that score, I do believe that we are self-evolving, that when you have an intention to evolve, let's say, any aspect of you, your vocation, because that's the most obvious one for me, and you are placing your yearning for deeper life purpose within that impulse from the universal source of creation, you get a boost in there. And then another form of spiritual practice I have is my journal writing. I have about 174 volumes of journal, and I have developed a practice over many, many years of every morning being silent, doing something like the evolutionary chakra meditation and a TM or something to quiet my mind, which isn't all that easy. But then to say, here's the situation, and I'll write just whatever it is that's concerning me or interest to me. And then I develop a poised mind. And I ask, what does this mean? And it's not like channeling. It's expanded knowing. And I have written very deep insights. And then what I do, I call it inner scripture, then I go and highlight those elements that seemed very pertinent to me, And if they have an action in them, I will test out the action and then come back and sort of report to the essential self. And I'm in a continual interactive dialogue with that higher knowing. And I think of it when I, in my studies of Aurobindo, of the stages, you know, from the mental mind all the way on up to the intuitive, the overmind, until you finally move to supramental, which is, would be the universal intelligence as you, which is not what I've been able to do yet. But I can feel higher mind coming in through poised mental mind. And I have been guided through, I was going to say billions of years, through all the years of my waking up and feeling so lost in the late 50s to being an evolutionary woman has been 90% through journal, asking, listening, writing, and then deep resonance with two or more people of sharing these kinds of insights until you really know more and more and more.
Mm. Beautiful. Thank you. That was a great answer. We have a question. Well, we kind of touched on this already, but it's good to make it more explicit. Melanie from Montreal asks, does evolution equal God?
Yes. Yes. The impulse of evolution, if you think of, I like Aurobindo's phrase, consciousness force. So let's say there's pure consciousness that is eternal and non-changing, out of which everything is arising. Consciousness force has direction, will, purpose. And as he describes it, let's say an atom is intelligent but not necessarily conscious, and so on up the chain of life until you get us being conscious of the consciousness force as the impulse of our own expression. So I believe that the evolving Godhead, God force, is evolution.
Mm.
And
expresses itself as evolution.
As evolution. And conscious evolution on the spiritual level is becoming aware of that impulse as the evolving Godhead.
Mm. Yeah. There's a related question from Hugo in Halifax, Nova Scotia, I guess. Is conscious evolution, in your opinion, a religious faith? Along the
same
lines.
I don't use the word religious. You know, the root of the word religion is religare, to bind back and make whole. In that sense, yes. But, you know, I always have a struggle when they sometimes in your... have to put down what religion you are, and I say a conscious evolutionary, but then I get into trouble because I wonder if that's a terrorist or something. So I don't put down any religion. I put down Episcopalian because I once tried to be an Episcopalian. But for somebody who's inspired by Teilhard, Aurobindo, Bucky, etc., Ken Wilber has been a great inspiration in my life. As have you, Terry, in your whole integral life teaching. So here's a real good question for all of us. What are the basic sacraments of conscious evolution? What are the emerging, I don't mean just occasional rituals, but think of the importance of the Eucharist, which I love. I mean, I'm Catholic small c, that I love the Eucharist, take, eat, this is my body, this is the blood of God, consuming it. And I, for many years, did a lot of just doing the communion. Then I began to realize, what is the body of God? It's not just Christ. The body of God is the body of the universal process of creation. It's the body of the fullness of the the God force incarnate. So we have a tradition here of doing communion with the whole story of creation. You know, Jesus said, take this in remembrance of me. So we're saying, let's consume the story of creation in remembrance of the awesome genius of evolution. And when you do that, you bring yourself up into what I call the wheel of co-creation, and then you ask, what is emergent in me now? And when you feel yourself to be an expression of the billions of years that it took for you to exist, and you just ask in all humility, what is that process emerging as me now? Not just what am I going to do, but what does that process express itself as me when I'm in attunement with it? And if you do that, I've created a little pamphlet called Evolutionary Communion, and I'm going to make that available because I did three little CDs, and I wrote this out so that anybody can do these practices. And I think it's really important that we have sacred practices for conscious evolution.
Well, this actually raises an interesting question that one of our listeners placed. Just a second, I'm calling it back up. Having some trouble getting it. Well, I think this was from Greg in Altadena, and he was essentially asking, I feel really inspired by this, but I don't feel particularly inspired to do the kinds of things I see you and Terry doing. He was more or less saying, I'm not inspired to speak or write books or be an evangelist of conscious evolution. How can I be, you know, what are the other expressions of this evolutionary impulse? How might I respond to this? And then there was another interesting question from a woman named, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, Paula Tresentis or something in Adelaide, who was kind of saying, do I sense this by sensing into my own truth? Is that how I do this? You know, so I think that was those kind of paired interestingly. I wonder what you'd say to, you know, in that domain.
Oh, that's a very, very important question. You know, in my understanding, we are like a social body. The people, as we emerge now, and I think of it as organs in the social body. There's the organ of communication that Terry and I are doing right now. There's the organ of production. There's the organ of environment and energy. There's the organ of distribution. And you can see it as a wheel of co-creation with functions. And it's my intuition that every one of us is a member of the one planetary body. That's obvious. We've seen ourselves from space. Every one of us has a unique expression of creativity. And when we get close enough to being able to discover and express that unique creativity, it takes us into, you know, any possible function that is part of the social body. And if we have 50 trillion cells making just one biological body, well, we're only up to 7 billion on this planet. You know, ultimately, everyone has a unique function within the social body. And so Terry and I, by far, have one of the very, you know, we have a lovely function, but good Lord, it's by no means everything at all. And the way you get in touch with it, you get in touch with it, first of all, by finding where is your frustration, and then you begin to ask of that frustration what attracts you at all. And then I call this the compass of joy. You simply follow what attracts you to give, to express. And it could be any function. It could be from the simplest function of mothering and gardening and cooking and cleaning and creating to high-level genius innovations. Whatever attracts you to give is the sign of what is your impulse of creation.
Hmm. And how is that different than it was for someone before this vision of evolution arose? Like, is there a way that participating in this discussion and engaging in this inspiration and doing this chakra meditation changes the context out of which that natural attraction expresses evolution?
Well, you know, of course, we have been evolving all along. The difference in this particular generation is, first of all, we saw we have so much power we could destroy our own life support system. This is a great wake-up call. And we also have these mass communication. Like, Facebook is the fourth largest nation in the world. China, India, U.S., Facebook. Well, what does this mean? It means that the communication nervous system of humanity is now connecting people for relationships, for friends, for connections, for communications. And I really believe that we are going to create the new social structures out of the fact of the interaction of people creating. That's where it is. It's not going to be on the top down. It's not the President of the United States. They can do this. It's pretty obvious. It's not the United Nations. It's not the head of global corporations. They're structured wrong. And I forget just what my point was here, except to say that it's going to be the uprising of creativity connecting that will give us the signature of the emerging culture of humanity.
Well, that's beautiful. I want to ask another question of comes from Brenda in Nelsonville, Ohio, who says, evolution is a very slow process, isn't it? Whereas growth is a very quick process. Isn't it possible that we're not really evolving, but learning and growing instead?
Well, you know, you mentioned in the beginning this phrase, a punctuated equilibrium. It's very true. Evolution can proceed at an extremely slow pace, but then when it hits a certain level of crisis, there can be a very fast jump. And I was just reading Ken Wilber the other day about the miracle of a simultaneous, unconnected mutations connecting quickly to make a new possibility, a new organism. And so there is a tendency in nature to evolve, as you can see it if you look at the story of evolution. So when you place yourself in that story, it was very slow to begin with. You know, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Homo Neanderthal, Homo sapiens, Homo sapiens sapiens. Maybe about 40,000 years ago, we gained self-reflective consciousness. And once language came in, progress became exogenetic, outside the genetic code, and it became cultural. And cultural evolution goes very much faster than biological evolution. And when you add scientific and technological advances that are speeding up at an exponential rate, I don't think there's any doubt at all that we're in an evolutionary situation here. And we're still, as individuals, having to grow and learn. So that doesn't mean that your evolution or mine is suddenly totally enhanced, but we're part of a system that itself is radically evolving.
What a beautiful way to reach the conclusion of this wonderful interview. That was just a perfect way to wrap it up, Barbara. I thank you, everybody, and thank you so much, Barbara. This is really
I love talking to you, Terry. I could talk to you for hours. You know that.
And we have.
Oh, we have.
in the past,
Terry,
at least.
Thank you so much for what you're doing.
Thank you, Barbara.
Evolving wisdom, you know, what you're setting up here for humanity is just a tremendous strange attractor.
Yeah, thank you, thank you. Well, please hang on the line for just a couple more minutes. I'll open up the phone lines and we can hear at least some of the folks on the line say goodbye. And,
all right.
And I'll tell everybody what's coming up next week and a few reminders. Please be sure to check out our blog at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog, where I periodically post, and there's been a lively exchange recently over the last few weeks. Also, we have a Facebook group at beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook. And if you or anybody you know might be interested in this series, please forward them an email or just direct them to register at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested to learn about my work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And to find out more about Barbara's work, get her newsletter at evolvingnow.com or at barbaramarkshubbard.com. You can get other resources. And I want to thank Bay Area Integral, which works to create a vibrant, thriving community of integral practitioners in the San Francisco Bay Area. Its purpose is to pioneer the playground where integral culture evolves. And if you're in the greater San Francisco Bay Area, you'll want to visit bayareaintegral.com to get on the mailing list. And also, this Wednesday, Bay Area Integral will be hosting its first annual God in Everybody, All Quadrant, Pre-Trans Gala Christmas Party. That's bayareaintegral.com. And also our Sisters in Evolution at Feminine Power, where evolutionary women around the world are waking up to the extraordinary and committed passion of their feminine power. You can find out more about the acclaimed work of Claire Zammit and Catherine Woodward Thomas and download a free 75-minute audio introduction at The Keys to Feminine Power, Awakening the Three Power Bases of the New Co-Creative Feminine at femininepower.com. And please remember to tune in on Thursday, December 9th at 5 p.m. Pacific. That's just 4 days from now. I'll be speaking with the dynamic young American spiritual teacher Adya Shanti. And it will be titled The Inner Revolution of Spiritual Awakening. What he says about that inner revolution is spiritual awakening opens the door to a life lived directly from spirit rather than from the mind. In order to live this way, we must step completely out of the known, out of every conceptual box, every container that humanity has ever created, so that the freshness of spirit can flower ever new and free. And then next Sunday, a week from today, December 12th, again at 5 p.m., I'll be speaking with Dr. and Rabbi Mark Gaffney. Following Thursday, December 16th, I'll be speaking with Integral Enlightenment Pioneer Craig Hamilton. So thank you so much for joining me and Barbara tonight. Let's open up the phone lines and say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Namaste. Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Love.
So wonderful.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you so much.
Oh.